Nightlife. A few words about Rat Kiley. I wasn't there when he got hurt, but Mitchell Sanders later told me the essential facts. Apparently, he lost his cool. The platoon had been working an AO out of the foothills west of Quanggai City, and for some time they'd been receiving intelligence about an NVA buildup in the area. The usual crazy rumors, massed artillery and Russian tanks and whole divisions of fresh troops. No one took it seriously, including Lieutenant Cross. But as a precaution, the platoon moved only at night, staying off the main trails and observing strict field SOPs. For almost 2 weeks, Sanders says, they lived the nightlife. That was the phrase everyone used, the nightlife, a language trick. It made things seem tolerable. "How's the NOM treating you?" one guy would ask, and some other guy would say, "Hey, one big party, just living the nightlife." It was a tense time for everybody, Sanders said. But for Rat Kiley, it ended up in Japan. The strain was too much for him. He couldn't make the adjustment. During those 2 weeks, the basic routine was simple. They'd sleep away the daylight hours, or try to sleep. Then at dusk, they'd put on their gear and move out single file into the dark. Always a heavy cloud cover. No moon and no stars. It was the purest black you could imagine, Sanders said. The kind of clock-stopping black that God must have had in mind when he sat down to invent blackness. It made your eyeballs ache. You'd shake your head and blink, except you couldn't even tell you were blinking. The blackness didn't change. So pretty soon you'd get jumpy. Your nerves would go. You'd start to worry about getting cut off from the rest of the unit, alone, you'd think. And then the real panic would bang in, and you'd reach out and try to touch the guy in front of you, groping for his shirt, hoping to Christ he was still there. It made for some bad dreams. Dave Jensen popped special vitamins high in carotene. Lieutenant Cross popped no-dose. Henry Dobbins and Norman Bowker even rigged up a safety line between them, a long piece of wire tied to their belts. The whole platoon felt the impact. With Rat Kiley, though, it was different. Too many body bags, maybe. Too much gore. At first, Rat just sank inside himself, not saying a word. But then, later on, after 5 or 6 days, it flipped the other way. He couldn't stop talking. Wacky talk, too. Talking about bugs, for instance. How the worst thing in Nam was the goddamn bugs. Big, giant killer bugs, he'd say. Mutant bugs. Bugs with fucked up DNA. Bugs that were chemically altered by napalm and defoliants and tear gas and DDT. He claimed the bugs were personally after his ass. He said he could hear the bastards homing in on him. Swarms of mutant bugs, billions of them. They had him bracketed, whispering his name, he said. His actual name, all night long. It was driving him crazy. Odd stuff, Sanders said, and it wasn't just talk. Rat developed some peculiar habits, constantly scratching himself, clawing at the bug bites. He couldn't quit digging at his skin, making big scabs and then ripping off the scabs and scratching the open sores. It was a sad thing to watch. Definitely not the old Rat Kiley. His whole personality seemed out of kilter. To an extent, though, everybody was feeling it. The long night marches turned their minds upside down. All the rhythms were wrong, always a lost sensation. They'd blunder along through the dark, willy-nilly, no sense of place or direction, probing for an enemy that nobody could see. Like a snipe hunt, Sanders said, a bunch of dumb Cub Scouts chasing the phantoms. They'd march north for a time, then east, then north again, skirting the villages, no one talking except in whispers. And it was rugged country, too. Not quite mountains, but rising fast, full of gorges and deep brush and places you could die. Around midnight, things always got wild. All around you, everywhere, the whole dark countryside came alive. You'd hear a strange hum in your ears. Nothing specific, nothing you could put a name on. Tree frogs, maybe, or snakes, or flying squirrels, or who knew what. Like the night had its own voice, that hum in your ears. And in the hours after midnight, you'd swear you were walking through some kind of soft, black protoplasm. Vietnam. The blood and the flesh. It was no joke, Sanders said. The monkeys chattered death chatter. The nights got freaky. Rat Kiley finally hit the wall. He couldn't sleep during the hot daylight hours. He couldn't cope with the nights. Late one afternoon, as the platoon prepared for another march, he broke down in front of Mitchell Sanders, not crying, but up against it. He said he was scared, and it wasn't normal scared. He didn't know what it was. Too long in country, probably, or else he wasn't cut out to be a medic. Always policing up the parts, he said, always plugging up holes. Sometimes he'd stare at guys who were still okay, the alive guys, and he'd start to picture how they'd look dead, without arms or legs, that sort of thing. It was ghoulish, he knew that, but he couldn't shut off the pictures. He'd be sitting there talking with Bowker or Dobbins or somebody, just marking time, and then out of nowhere he'd find himself wondering how much the guy's head weighed, like how heavy it was, and what it would feel like to pick up the head and carry it over to a chopper and dump it in. Rat scratched the skin at his elbow, digging in hard. His eyes were red and weary. "It's not right," he said. "These pictures in my head, they won't quit. I'll see a guy's liver, the actual fucking liver, and the thing is, it doesn't scare me. It doesn't even give me the willies. More like curiosity, the way a doctor feels when he looks at a patient. Sort of mechanical, not seeing the real person, just a ruptured appendix or a clogged up artery." His voice floated away for a second. He looked at Sanders and tried to smile. He kept clawing at his elbow. "Anyway," Rat said, "the days aren't so bad, but at night the pictures get to be a bitch. I start seeing my own body, chunks of myself, my own heart, my own kidneys. It's like, I don't know, it's like staring into this huge black crystal ball. One of these nights I'll be lying dead out there in the dark and nobody will find me except the bugs. I can see it. I can see the goddamn bugs chewing tunnels through me. I can see the mongooses munching on my bones. I swear it's too much. I can't keep seeing myself dead." Mitchell Sanders nodded. He didn't know what to say. For a time they sat watching the shadows come. Then Rat shook his head. He said he'd done his best. He tried to be a decent medic. Win some and lose some, he said. But he tried hard. Briefly then, rambling a little, he talked about a few of the guys who were gone now, Kurt Lemon and Kiowa and Ted Lavender, and how crazy it was that people who were so incredibly alive could get so incredibly dead. Then he almost laughed. "This whole war," he said, "you know what it is? Just one big banquet. Meat, man. You and me, everybody, meat for the bugs." The next morning he shot himself. He took off his boots and socks, laid out his medical kit, doped himself up, and put a round through his foot. Nobody blamed him, Sanders said. Before the chopper came, there was time for goodbyes. Lieutenant Cross went over and said he'd vouch that it was an accident. Henry Dobbins and Azar gave him a stack of comic books for hospital reading. Everybody stood in a little circle, feeling bad about it, trying to cheer him up with bullshit about the great nightlife in Japan. The Lives of the Dead. But this, too, is true. Stories can save us. I'm 43 years old and a writer now, and even still, right here, I keep dreaming Linda alive, and Ted Lavender, too, and Kiowa, and Kurt Lemon, and a slim young man I killed, and an old man sprawled beside a pig pen, and several others whose bodies I once lifted and dumped into a truck. They're all dead. But in a story, which is a kind of dreaming, the dead sometimes smile and sit up and return to the world. Start here, a body without a name. On an afternoon in 1969, the platoon took sniper fire from a filthy little village along the South China Sea. It lasted only a minute or two, and nobody was hurt. But even so, Lieutenant Jimmy Cross got on the radio and ordered up an airstrike. For the next half hour, we watched the place burn. It was a cool, bright morning, like early autumn, and the jets were glossy black against the sky. When it ended, we formed into a loose line and swept east through the village. It was all wreckage. I remember the smell of burnt straw. I remember broken fences and torn-up trees and heaps of stone and brick and pottery. The place was deserted. No people, no animals. and the only confirmed kill was an old man who lay face up near a pig pen at the center of the village. His right arm was gone. At his face there were already many flies and gnats. Dave Jensen went over and shook the old man's hand. "Howdy do," he said. One by one the others did it too. They didn't disturb the body, they just grabbed the old man's hand and offered a few words and moved away. Rat Kiley bent over the corpse. "Give me five," he said. "A real honor."
"Pleased as punch," said Henry Dobbins.
I was brand new to the war. It was my fourth day. I hadn't yet developed a sense of humor. Right away, as if I'd swallowed something, I felt a moist sickness rise up in my throat. I sat down beside the pig pen, closed my eyes, put my head between my knees. After a moment, Dave Jensen touched my shoulder.
"Be polite now," he said. "Go introduce yourself. Nothing to be afraid about. Just a nice old man. Show a little respect for your elders."
"No way."
"Maybe it's too real for you."
"That's right," I said. "Way too real." Jensen kept after me, but I didn't go near the body. I didn't even look at it except by accident. For the rest of the day, there was still that sickness inside me, but it wasn't the old man's corpse so much. It was that awesome act of greeting the dead. At one point, I remember, they sat the body up against a fence. They crossed his legs and talked to him. "The guest of honor," Mitchell Sanders said, and he placed a can of orange slices in the old man's lap. "Vitamin C," he said gently. "A guy's health. That's the most important thing." They proposed toasts. They lifted their canteens and drank to the old man's family and ancestors, his many grandchildren, his newfound life after death. It was more than mockery. There was a formality to it, like a funeral without the sadness. Dave Jensen flicked his eyes at me.
"Hey, O'Brien," he said, "you got a toast in mind?"
"Never too late for manners."
I found things to do with my hands. I looked away and tried not to think. Late in the afternoon, just before dusk, Kiowa came up and asked if he could sit at my foxhole for a minute. He offered me a Christmas cookie from a batch his father had sent him. It was February now, but the cookies tasted fine. For a few moments, Kiowa watched the sky.
"You did a good thing today," he said. "That shaking hands crap, it is indecent. The guys hassle you for a while, especially Jensen, but just keep saying no. Should have done it myself. Takes guts, I know that."
"It wasn't guts. I was scared."
Kiowa shrugged. "Same difference."
"No, I couldn't do it. A mental block or something. I don't know. Just creepy."
"Well, you're new here. You'll get used to it."
He paused for a second, studying the green and red sprinkles on a cookie.
"Today, I guess this was your first look at a real body?"
I shook my head. All day long, I'd been picturing Linda's face, the way she smiled.
"It sounds funny," I said, "but that poor old man, he reminds me of... I mean, there's this girl I used to know. I took her to the movies once, my first date."
Kiowa looked at me for a long while. Then he leaned back and smiled.
"Man," he said, "that's a bad date."
Linda was 9 then, as I was, but we were in love, and it was real. When I write about her now, 3 decades later, it's tempting to dismiss it as a crush, an infatuation of childhood, but I know for a fact that what we felt for each other was as deep and rich as love can ever get. It had all the shadings and complexities of mature adult love, and maybe more, because there were not yet words for it, and because it was not yet fixed to comparisons or chronologies or the ways by which adults measure such things. I just loved her. She had poise and great dignity. Her eyes, I remember, were deep brown like her hair, and she was slender and very quiet and fragile-looking. Even then, at 9 years old, I wanted to live inside her body. I wanted to melt into her bones, that kind of love. And so in the spring of 1956, when we were in the 4th grade, I took her out on the first real date of my life.
a double date, actually, with my mother and father. Though I can't remember the exact sequence, my mother had somehow arranged it with Linda's parents, and on that damp spring night, my dad did the driving while Linda and I sat in the back seat and stared out opposite windows, both of us trying to pretend it was nothing special. For me, though, it was very special. Down inside, I had important things to tell her, big, profound things, but I couldn't make any words come out. I had trouble breathing. Now and then I'd glance over at her, thinking how beautiful she was, her white skin and those dark brown eyes, and the way she always smiled at the world, always, it seemed, as if her face had been designed that way. The smile never went away. That night, I remember, she wore a new red cap, which seemed to me very stylish and sophisticated, very unusual. It was a stocking cap, basically, except the tapered part at the top seemed extra long, almost too long, like a tail growing out of the back of her head. It made me think of the caps that Santa's elves wear, the same shape and color, the same fuzzy white tassel at the tip. Sitting there in the back seat, I wanted to find some way to let her know how I felt, a compliment of some sort, but all I could manage was a stupid comment about the cap. "Jeez," I must have said, "what a cap." Linda smiled at the window. She knew what I meant. But my mother turned and gave me a hard look. It surprised me. It was as if I brought up some horrible secret. For the rest of the ride, I kept my mouth shut. We parked in front of the Ben Franklin store and walked up Main Street toward the State Theater. My parents went first, side by side, and then Linda in her new red cap, and then me, tailing along 10 or 20 steps behind. I was 9 years old. I didn't yet have the gift for small talk. Now and then my mother glanced back, making little motions with her hand to speed me up. At the ticket booth, I remember, Linda stood off to one side. I moved over to the concession area, studying the candy, and both of us were very careful to avoid the awkwardness of eye contact, which was how we knew about being in love. It was pure knowing. Neither of us, I suppose, would have thought to use that word, love, but by the fact of not looking at each other and not talking, we understood with a clarity beyond language that we were sharing something huge and permanent. Behind me in the theater, I heard cartoon music. "Hey, step it up," I said. I almost had the courage to look at her. "You want popcorn or what?" The thing about a story is that you dream it as you tell it, hoping that others might then dream along with you. And in this way, memory and imagination and language combine to make spirits in the head. There is the illusion of aliveness. In Vietnam, for instance, Ted Lavender had a habit of popping 4 or 5 tranquilizers every morning. It was his way of coping, just dealing with the realities. And the drugs helped to ease him through the days. I remember how peaceful his eyes were. Even in bad situations, he had a soft, dreamy expression on his face, which was what he wanted, a kind of escape. "How's the war today?" somebody would ask. And Ted Lavender would give a little smile to the sky and say, "Mellow, a nice smooth war today." And then in April he was shot in the head outside the village of Tonkay. Kiowa and I and a couple of others were ordered to prepare his body for the dust-off. I remember squatting down, not wanting to look, but then looking. Lavender's left cheekbone was gone. There was a swollen blackness around his eye. Quickly, trying not to feel anything, we went through the kids' pockets. I remember wishing I had gloves. It wasn't the blood I hated. It was the deadness. We put his personal effects in a plastic bag and tied the bag to his arm. We stripped off the canteens and ammo and all the heavy stuff and wrapped him up in his own poncho and carried him out to a dry paddy and laid him down. For a while, nobody said much. Then Mitchell Sanders laughed and looked over at the green plastic poncho. "Hey, Lavender," he said, "how's the war today?" There was a short quiet. "Mellow," somebody said. "Well, that's good," Sanders murmured. "That's real, real good. Stay cool now." "Hey, no sweat, I'm mellow." "Just ease on back then. Don't need no pills. Got this incredible chopper on call. This once-in-a-lifetime mind trip." "Oh, yeah, mellow." Mitchell Sanders smiled.
There it is, my man. This chopper's gonna take you up high and cool. Gonna relax you. Gonna alter your whole perspective on this sorry, sorry shit.
We could almost see Ted Lavender's dreamy blue eyes. We could almost hear him.
Roger that, somebody said. I'm ready to fly.
There was the sound of the wind, the sound of birds in the quiet afternoon, which was the world we were in. That's what a story does. The bodies are animated. You make the dead talk. They sometimes say things like, Roger that. Or they say, Timmy, stop crying. Which is what Linda said to me after she was dead. Even now I can see her walking down the aisle of the old State Theater in Worthington, Minnesota. I can see her face and profile beside me, the cheeks softly lighted by coming attractions. The movie that night was The Man Who Never Was. I remember the plot clearly, or at least the premise, because the main character was a corpse. That fact alone, I know, deeply impressed me. It was a World War II film. The Allies devise a scheme to mislead Germany about the site of the upcoming landings in Europe. They get their hands on a body, a British soldier, I believe. They dress him up in an officer's uniform, plant fake documents in his pockets, then dump him in the sea and let the currents wash him onto a Nazi beach. The Germans find the documents. The deception wins the war. Even now I can remember the awful splash as that corpse fell into the sea. I remember glancing over at Linda, thinking it might be too much for her. But in the dim gray light, she seemed to be smiling at the screen. There were little crinkles at her eyes, her lips open and gently curving at the corners. I couldn't understand it. There was nothing to smile at. Once, or twice, in fact, I had to close my eyes, but it didn't help much. Even then, I kept seeing the soldier's body tumbling toward the water, splashing down hard. How inert and heavy it was, how completely dead. It was a relief when the movie finally ended. Afterward, we drove out to the Dairy Queen at the edge of town. The night had a quilted, weighted-down quality, as if somehow burdened, and all around us the Minnesota prairies reached out in long, repetitive waves of corn and soybeans, everything flat, everything the same. I remember eating ice cream in the back seat of the Buick, and a long blank drive in the dark, and then pulling up in front of Linda's house. Things must have been said, but it's all gone now, except for a few last images. I remember walking her to the front door. I remember the brass porch light with its fierce yellow glow, my own feet, the juniper bushes along the front steps, the wet grass, Linda close beside me. We were in love. 9 years old, yes, but it was real love. And now we're alone on those front steps. Finally, we looked at each other. Bye, I said. Linda nodded and said, Bye. Over the next few weeks, Linda wore her new red cap to school every day. She never took it off, not even in the classroom. And so it was inevitable that she took some teasing about it. Most of it came from a kid named Nick Veenhoff. Out on the playground during recess, Nick would creep up behind her and make a grab for the cap, almost yanking it off, then scampering away. It went on like that for weeks, the girls giggling, the guys egging him on. Naturally, I wanted to do something about it, but it just wasn't possible. I had my reputation to think about. I had my pride. And there was also the problem of Nick Veenhoff. So I stood off to the side, just a spectator, wishing I could do things I couldn't do. I watched Linda clamp down the cap with the palm of her hand, holding it there, smiling over in Nick's direction as if none of it really mattered. For me, though, it did matter. It still does. I should have stepped in. Fourth grade is no excuse. Besides, it doesn't get easier with time. And 12 years later, when Vietnam presented much harder choices, some practice at being brave might have helped a little. Also, too, I might have stopped what happened next. Maybe not, but at least it's possible. Most of the details I've forgotten, or maybe blocked out. But I know it was an afternoon in late spring, and we were taking a spelling test. And halfway into the test, Nick Veenhoff held up his hand and asked to use the pencil sharpener. Right away, a couple of kids laughed. No doubt he'd broken the pencil on purpose. But it wasn't something you could prove, and so the teacher nodded and told him to hustle it up. which was a mistake. Out of nowhere, Nick developed a terrible limp. He moved in slow motion, dragging himself up to the pencil sharpener and carefully slipping in his pencil and then grinding away forever. At the time, I suppose, it was funny, but on the way back to his seat, Nick took a short detour. He squeezed between two desks, turned sharply right, and moved up the aisle toward Linda. I saw him grin at one of his pals. In a way, I already knew what was coming. As he passed Linda's desk, he dropped the pencil and squatted down to get it. When he came up, his left hand slipped behind her back. There was a half-second hesitation. Maybe he was trying to stop himself. Maybe then, just briefly, he felt some small approximation of guilt. But it wasn't enough. He took hold of the white tassel, stood up, and gently lifted off her cap. Somebody must have laughed. I remember a short, tinny echo. I remember Nick Veenhoff trying to smile. Somewhere behind me, a girl said, or a sound like that. Linda didn't move. Even now, when I think back on it, I could still see the glossy whiteness of her scalp. She wasn't bald, not quite, not completely. There were some tufts of hair, little patches of grayish-brown fuzz. But what I saw then and keep seeing now is all that whiteness. A smooth, pale, translucent white. I could see the bones and veins. I could see the exact structure of her skull. There was a large band-aid at the back of her head, a row of black stitches, a piece of gauze taped above her left ear. Nick Veenhoff took a step backward. He was still smiling, but the smile was doing strange things. The whole time Linda stared straight ahead, her eyes locked on the blackboard, her hands loosely folded at her lap. She didn't say anything. After a time, though, she turned and looked at me across the room. It lasted only a moment, but I had the feeling that a whole conversation was happening between us. "Well," she was saying, and I was saying, "Sure, okay." Later on, she cried for a while. The teacher helped her put the cap back on. Then we finished the spelling test and did some finger painting. And after school that day, Nick Veenhoff and I walked her home. It's now 1990. I'm 43 years old, which would have seemed impossible to a fourth grader. And yet, when I look at photographs of myself as I was in 1956, I realize that in important ways I haven't changed at all. I was Timmy then, now I'm Tim. But the essence remains the same. I'm not fooled by the baggy pants or the crew cut or the happy smile. I know my own eyes, and there's no doubt that the Timmy smiling at the camera is the Tim I am now. Inside the body or beyond the body, there is something absolute and unchanging. The human life is all one thing, like a blade tracing loops on ice, a little kid, a 23-year-old infantry sergeant, a middle-aged writer knowing guilt and sorrow. And as a writer now, I want to save Linda's life. Not her body, her life. She died, of course. 9 years old, and she died. It was a brain tumor. She lived through the summer and into the first part of September, and then she was dead. But in a story, I can steal her soul. I can revive, at least briefly, that which is absolute and unchanging. In a story, miracles can happen. Linda can smile and sit up. She can reach out, touch my wrist, and say, "Timmy, stop crying." I needed that kind of miracle. At some point, I had come to understand that Linda was sick, maybe even dying. But I loved her and just couldn't accept it. In the middle of the summer, I remember my mother tried to explain to me about brain tumors. Now and then, she said, "Bad things start growing inside us. Sometimes you can cut them out, and other times you can't. And for Linda, it was one of the times when you can't." I thought about it for several days. "All right," I finally said. "So, will she get better now?" "Well, no," my mother said. "I don't think so." She stared at a spot behind my shoulder. "Sometimes people don't ever get better. They die sometimes." I shook my head. "Not Linda," I said. But on a September afternoon, during noon recess, Nick Veenhoff came up to me on the school playground. "Your girlfriend," he said. "She kicked the bucket." At first, I didn't understand. "She's dead,"
he said. My mom told me at lunchtime. No lie, she actually kicked the goddamn bucket.
All I could do was nod. Somehow it didn't quite register. I turned away, glanced down at my hands for a second, then walked home without telling anyone. It was a little after 1 o'clock, I remember, and the house was empty. I drank some chocolate milk, and then lay down on the sofa in the living room. Not really sad, just floating, trying to imagine what it was to be dead. Nothing much came to me. I remember closing my eyes and whispering her name, almost begging, trying to make her come back. Linda, I said, please. And then I concentrated. I willed her alive. It was a dream, I suppose, or a daydream, but I made it happen. I saw her coming down the middle of Main Street all alone. It was nearly dark, and the street was deserted, no cars or people, and Linda wore a pink dress and shiny black shoes. I remember sitting down on the curb to watch. All her hair had grown back. The scars and stitches were gone. In the dream, if that's what it was, she was playing a game of some sort, laughing and running up the empty street, kicking a big aluminum water bucket. Right then, I started to cry. After a moment, Linda stopped and carried her water bucket over to the curb and asked why I was so sad.
Well, God, I said, you're dead.
Linda nodded at me. She was standing under a yellow streetlight, a 9-year-old girl, just a kid, and yet there was something ageless in her eyes, not a child, not an adult, just a bright, ongoing everness, that same pinprick of absolute lasting light that I see today in my own eyes as Timmy smiles at Tim from the graying photographs of that time. Dead, I said. Linda smiled. It was a secret smile, as if she knew things nobody could ever know. And she reached out and touched my wrist and said, Timmy, stop crying. It doesn't matter.
In Vietnam, too, we had ways of making the dead seem not quite so dead. Shaking hands, that was one way. By slighting death, by acting, we pretended it was not the terrible thing it was. By our language, which was both hard and wistful, we transformed the bodies into piles of waste. Thus, when someone got killed, as Kurt Lemon did, his body was not really a body, but rather one small bit of waste in the midst of a much wider wastage. I learned that words make a difference. It's easier to cope with a kicked bucket than a corpse. If it isn't human, it doesn't matter much if it's dead. And so a VC nurse, fried by napalm, was a crispy critter. A Vietnamese baby, which lay nearby, was a roasted peanut. Just a crunchy munchy, Rat Kylie said as he stepped over the body. We kept the dead alive with stories. When Ted Lavender was shot in the head, the men talked about how they'd never seen him so mellow, how tranquil he was, how it wasn't the bullet but the tranquilizers that blew his mind. He wasn't dead, just laid back. There were Christians among us, like Kiowa, who believed in the New Testament stories of life after death. Other stories were passed down like legends from old-timer to newcomer. Mostly, though, we had to make up our own. Often they were exaggerated or blatant lies, but it was a way of bringing body and soul back together, or a way of making new bodies for the souls to inhabit. There was a story, for instance, about how Kurt Lemon had gone trick-or-treating on Halloween. A dark, spooky night, and so Lemon put on a ghost mask and painted up his body all different colors and crept across a paddy to a sleeping village, almost stark naked, the story went, just boots and balls and an M16. And in the dark, Lemon went from hooch to hooch, ringing doorbells, he called it. And a few hours later, when he slipped back into the perimeter, he had a whole sackful of goodies to share with his pals. Candles and joss sticks, and a pair of black pajamas, and statuettes of the smiling Buddha. That was the story, anyway. Other versions were much more elaborate, full of descriptions and scraps of dialogue. Rat Kylie liked to spice it up with extra details. See, what happens is, it's like 4 in the morning, and Lemon sneaks into a hooch with that weird ghost mask on. Everybody's asleep, right? So he wakes up this cute little mama-san, tickles her foot. Hey, mama-san, he goes real soft, like, hey, mama-san, trick-or-treat.
should have seen her face. About freaks. I mean, there's this buck-naked ghost standing there, and he's got this M16 up against her ear, and he whispers, "Hey, Mama-san, trick or fucking treat." Then he takes off her PJs, strips her right down, sticks the pajamas in his sack, and tucks her into bed and heads for the next hooch.
Pausing a moment, Rat Kylie would grin and shake his head.
"Honest to God," he'd murmur, "trick or treat. Lemon, there's one class act."
To listen to the story, especially as Rat Kylie told it, you'd never know that Kurt Lemon was dead. He was still out there in the dark, naked and painted up, trick-or-treating, sliding from hooch to hooch in that crazy white ghost mask. But he was dead. In September, the day after Linda died, I asked my father to take me down to Benson's funeral home to view the body. I was a fifth grader then. I was curious. On the drive downtown, my father kept his eyes straight ahead. At one point, I remember, he made a scratchy sound in his throat. It took him a long time to light up a cigarette.
"Timmy," he said, "you're sure about this?"
I nodded at him. Down inside, of course, I wasn't sure. And yet I had to see her one more time. What I needed, I suppose, was some sort of final confirmation. Something to carry with me after she was gone.
When we parked in front of the funeral home, my father turned and looked at me. "If this bothers you," he said, "just say the word. We'll make a quick getaway. Fair enough?"
"Okay," I said.
"Or if you start to feel sick or anything."
"I won't," I told him.
Inside, the first thing I noticed was the smell, thick and sweet, like something sprayed out of a can. The viewing room was empty, except for Linda and my father and me. I felt a rush of panic as we walked up the aisle. The smell made me dizzy. I tried to fight it off, slowing down a little, taking short, shallow breaths through my mouth. But at the same time, I felt a funny excitement, anticipation, in a way, that same awkward feeling as when I walked up the sidewalk to ring her doorbell on our first date. I wanted to impress her. I wanted something to happen between us. A secret signal of some sort. The room was dimly lighted, almost dark. But at the far end of the aisle, Linda's white casket was illuminated by a row of spotlights up in the ceiling. Everything was quiet. My father put his hand on my shoulder, whispered something, and backed off. After a moment, I edged forward a few steps, pushing up on my toes for a better look. It didn't seem real. A mistake, I thought. The girl lying there in the white casket wasn't Linda. There was a resemblance, maybe, but where Linda had always been very slender and fragile-looking, almost skinny, the body in that casket was fat and swollen. For a second I wondered if somebody had made a terrible blunder, a technical mistake, pumped her too full of formaldehyde or embalming fluid or whatever they used. Her arms and face were bloated. The skin at her cheeks was stretched out tight like the rubber skin on a balloon just before it pops open. Even her fingers seemed puffy. I turned and glanced behind me where my father stood, thinking that maybe it was a joke, hoping it was a joke. Almost believing that Linda would jump out from behind one of the curtains and laugh and yell out my name. But she didn't. The room was silent. When I looked back at the casket, I felt dizzy again. In my heart, I'm sure I knew this was Linda, but even so, I couldn't find much to recognize. I tried to pretend she was taking a nap, her hands folded at her stomach, just sleeping away the afternoon. Except she didn't look asleep. She looked dead. She looked heavy and totally dead. I remember closing my eyes. After a while, my father stepped up beside me. "Come on now," he said. "Let's go get some ice cream." In the months after Ted Lavender died, there were many other bodies. I never shook hands, not that. But one afternoon, I climbed a tree and threw down what was left of Kurt Lemon. I watched my friend Kiowa sink into the muck along the Songtra Bong. And in early July, after a battle in the mountains, I was assigned to a 6-man detail to police up the enemy KIAs. There were 27 bodies altogether, and parts of several others. The dead were everywhere. Some lay in piles, some lay alone. One, I remember, seemed to kneel, Another was bent from the waist over a small boulder, the top of his head on the ground, his arms rigid, the eyes squinting in concentration, as if he were about to perform a handstand or somersault. It was my worst day at the war. For 3 hours we carried the bodies down the mountain to a clearing alongside a narrow dirt road. We had lunch there. Then a truck pulled up, and we worked in two-man teams to load the truck. I remember swinging the bodies up. Mitchell Sanders took a man's feet, I took the arms, and we counted to three, working up momentum, and then we tossed the body high and watched it bounce and come to rest among other bodies. The dead had been dead for more than a day. They were all badly bloated. Their clothing was stretched tight like sausage skins, and when we picked them up, some made sharp burping sounds as the gases were released. They were heavy. Their feet were bluish-green and cold. The smell was terrible. At one point, Mitchell Sanders looked at me and said, "Hey, man, I just realized something." "What?" He wiped his eyes and spoke very quietly, as if awed by his own wisdom. "Death sucks," he said. Lying in bed at night, I made up elaborate stories to bring Linda alive in my sleep. I invented my own dreams. It sounds impossible, I know, but I did it. I'd picture somebody's birthday party, a crowded room, I think, and a big chocolate cake with pink candles, and then soon I'd be dreaming it, and after a while Linda would show up, as I knew she would. And in the dream we'd look at each other and not talk much, because we were shy. But then later I'd walk her home, and we'd sit on her front steps and stare at the dark and just be together. She'd say amazing things sometimes. "Once you're alive," she'd say, "you can't ever be dead." Or she'd say, "Do I look dead?" It was a kind of self-hypnosis, partly willpower, partly faith, which is how stories arrive. But back then it felt like a miracle. My dreams had become a secret meeting place, and in the weeks after she died, I couldn't wait to fall asleep at night. I began going to bed earlier and earlier, sometimes even in bright daylight. My mother, I remember, finally asked about it at breakfast one morning. "Timmy, what's wrong?" she said, but all I could do was shrug and say, "Nothing. I just need sleep, that's all." I didn't dare tell the truth. It was embarrassing, I suppose. But it was also a precious secret, like a magic trick, where if I tried to explain it or even talk about it, the thrill and mystery would be gone. I didn't want to lose Linda. She was dead. I understood that. After all, I had seen her body. And yet, even as a 9-year-old, I'd begun to practice the magic of stories. Some I just dreamed up. Others I wrote down, the scenes and dialogue. And at nighttime, I'd slide into sleep knowing that Linda would be there waiting for me. Once, I remember, we went ice skating late at night, tracing loops and circles under yellow floodlights. Later, we sat by a wood stove in the warming house, all alone, and after a while, I asked her what it was like to be dead. Apparently, Linda thought it was a silly question. She smiled and said, "Do I look dead?" I told her no, she looked terrific. I waited a moment, then asked again, and Linda made a soft little sigh. I could smell our wool mittens drying on the stove. For a few seconds she was quiet. "Well, right now," she said, "I'm not dead. But when I am, it's like, I don't know, I guess it's like being inside a book that nobody's reading." "A book?" I said. "An old one. It's up on a library shelf, so you're safe and everything. But the book hasn't been checked out for a long, long time. All you can do is wait. Just hope somebody'll pick it up and start reading." Linda smiled at me. "Anyhow, it's not so bad," she said. "I mean, when you're dead, you just have to be yourself." She stood up and put on her red stocking cap. "This is stupid. Let's go skate some more." So I followed her down to the frozen pond. It was late and nobody else was there. And we held hands and skated almost all night under the yellow lights. And then it becomes 1990. I'm 43 years old and a writer now, still dreaming Linda alive in exactly the same way. She's not the embodied Linda. She's mostly made up with a new identity and new name, like the man who never was. Her real name doesn't matter. She was 9 years old. I loved her, and then she died. And yet right here, in the spell of memory and imagination, I can still see her as if through ice, as if I'm gazing into some other world, a place where there are no brain tumors and no funeral homes, where there are no bodies at all. I can see Kiowa, too, and Ted Lavender, and Kurt Lemon, and sometimes I can even see Timmy skating with Linda under the yellow floodlights. I'm young and happy. I'll never die. I'm skimming across the surface of my own history, moving fast, riding the melt beneath the blades, doing loops and spins, and when I take a high leap into the dark and come down 30 years later, I realize it is as Tim, trying to save Timmy's life with a story.
In 1994, a few years after The Things They Carried was published, the author Tim O'Brien wrote this factual account of his return to Vietnam for the New York Times, called The Vietnam in Me. The author recently narrated the essay for Audible.
The Vietnam in Me, written and read by me, Tim O'Brien. Elsie Gator, Vietnam, February 1994. I'm home, but the house is gone. Not a sandbag, not a nail, or a scrap of wire. On Gator, we used to say, the wind doesn't blow. It sucks. Maybe that's what happened. The wind sucked it all away. My life, my virtue. In February 1969, 25 years ago, I arrived as a young, terrified PFC on this lonely little hill in Quang Nai Province. Back then, the place seemed huge and imposing and permanent, a forward fire base for the 5th Battalion of the 46th Infantry, 198th Infantry Brigade. Elsie Gator was home to 700 or 800 American soldiers, mostly grunts. I remember a tar helipad, a mess hall, a medical station, mortar and artillery emplacements, 2 volleyball courts, numerous barracks and offices and supply depots and machine shops and entertainment clubs. Gator was our castle. Not safe exactly, but far preferable to the bush. No landmines here, no paddies bubbling with machine gun fire. Maybe once a month, for 3 or 4 days at a time, Alpha Company would return to Gator for stand-down, where we took our comforts behind a perimeter of bunkers and concertina wire. There were hot showers and hot meals, ice chests packed with beer, glossy pin-up girls, big black Sony tape decks booming, "We gotta get out of this place," at decibels for the deaf. 30 or 40 acres of almost America. With a little weed and a lot of beer, we would spend the days of stand-down in flat-out celebration, purely alive, taking pleasure in our own biology, kidneys and livers and lungs and legs, all in their proper alignments. We could breathe here. We could feel our fists uncurl, the pressures approaching normal. The real war, it seemed, was in another solar system. By day, we'd fill sandbags or pull bunker guard. In the evenings, there were outdoor movies and sometimes live floor shows, pretty Korean girls breaking our hearts in their spangled miniskirts and high leather boots. Then afterward, we'd troop back to the Alpha Barracks for some letter writing or boozing or just a good night's sleep. So much to remember. The time we filled a nasty lieutenant's canteen with mosquito repellent, the sounds of choppers and artillery fire, the slow dread that began building as word spread that in a day or two we'd be heading back to the bush, Pinkville maybe, the Batangan Peninsula, spooky, evil places where the land itself could kill you. Now I stand in this patch of weeds, looking down on what used to be the old Alpha Barracks. Amazing, really, what time can do. You'd think there would be something left, some faint imprint, but Elsie Gator had been utterly and forever erased from the earth. Nothing here but ghosts and wind. At the foot of Gator, along Highway 1, the little hamlet of Nookmaw is going bonkers over our arrival here. As we turn and walk down the hill, maybe 200 people trail along, gawking and chattering, the children reaching out to touch our skin. Through our interpreter, Mrs. Lei Hua Feng, I'm told that I am the first American soldier to return to this place in the 24 years since Gator was evacuated in 1970. In a strange way, the occasion has the feel of a reunion. Happy faces, much bowing. "Me Wendy," says a middle-aged woman. Another says Flower. Wendy and Flower. GI nicknames retrieved from a quarter century ago. An elderly woman, perhaps in her late 70s, tugs at my shirt and says, "My name Mama-san." Dear God, we should have bombed these people with love. Cambridge, Massachusetts, June 1994. Last night, suicide was on my mind. Not whether, but how. Tonight, it will be on my mind again. Now it's 4 a.m., June the 5th. The sleeping pills have not worked. I sit in my underwear at this unblinking fool of a computer and try to wrap words around a few horrid truths. I returned to Vietnam with a young woman whose name is Kate, whom I adored and have since lost. She's with another man, 7 blocks away. This I learned yesterday afternoon. My own fault, Kate would say, and she would be mostly right, not entirely. In any case, these thoughts are probably too intimate, too awkward and embarrassing for public discussion. But who knows? Maybe a little blunt human truth will send you off to church or to confession or inside yourself. Not that it matters. For me, with one eye on these smooth yellow pills, the world must be written about as it is, or not written about at all. Elsie Gator, February 1994. By chance, Kate and I have arrived in Nookmaw on a day of annual commemoration, a day when the graves of the local war dead are blessed and repaired and decorated and wept over. The village elders invite us to a feast, a picnic of sorts, where we take seats before a low, lacquered table at an outdoor shrine. Children press up close, all around. The elders shoo them away, but the shooing doesn't do much. I'm getting nervous. The food on display seems a bit exotic, not to my taste. I look at Kate. Kate looks at me. "Number one chop chop," an old woman says, a wrinkled, gorgeous, protective, scarred, welcoming old woman. "Number one," she promises, and nudges Kate, and smiles a heartbreaking beetle nut smile. I choose something white. Fish, I'm guessing. I have eaten herring. I have enjoyed herring. This is not herring. There are decisions to be made. The elders bow and execute chewing motions. Do not forget, our hosts are among the maimed and widowed and orphaned, the bombed and rebombed, the recipients of white phosphorus, the tenders of graves. Chew, they say, and by God, I chew. Kate has the good fortune to find a Kleenex. She's a pro. She executes a polite wiping motion, and it's over for her. Eddie Keating, a New York Times photographer, tucks his portion between cheek and gum, where it remains until the feast concludes. Me, I imagine herring. I remember Sunday afternoons as a boy, the Vikings on TV, my dad opening up the crackers and creamed herring, passing it out at halftime. Other flashes, too. Elsie Gator's mortar rounds pounding this innocent, impoverished, raped little village. 8 or 9 corpses piled not 50 yards from where we now sit in friendly union. I prepare myself, foul for sure, but things come around. Nookmaw swallowed plenty. The Song Tra Hotel, Klang Yai City, February 1994. It's late in the evening. The air conditioner is at full Cuban power. Kate's eyes sparkle. She's laughing. Swallowed, she kept saying. In 1969, when I went to war, Kate was 3 years old. Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, McNamara, Bunker, Rogers, Bundy, Rusk, Abrams, Rostow. For her, these names are like the listings on a foreign menu. Some she recognizes not at all. Some she recalls from books or old television clips. But she never tasted the dishes. She does not know ice cream from Brussels sprouts. 3 years old, how could she? No more than I could know the Southern California of her own youth. Still, it was Kate who insisted we come here. I was more than reluctant. I was petrified. I looked for excuses, bad dreams and so on. But Kate's enthusiasm won me over. She wanted to share in my past, the shapes of things, the smells and sunlight. As it turns out, the sharing has gone both ways. In any other circumstances, I would have returned to this country almost purely as a veteran, caught up in memory. But Kate's presence has made me pay attention to the details of here and now, a Vietnam that exists outside the old perimeter of war. She takes delight in things alive, a chicken wired to somebody's bicycle, an old woman's enormous fingernails, an infant slung casually on the hip of a tiny 7-year-old girl. Kate has the eyes and spirit of an adventurer, wide open to the variety of the world, and these qualities have pushed me toward some modest adventurism of my own. Now I watch her fiddle with the air conditioner. Swallowed, she keeps saying. Later in the night, as on many other nights, we talk about the war. I try to explain, ineptly no doubt, that Vietnam was more than terror. For me at least, Vietnam was partly love. With each step, each light year of a second, a foot soldier is always almost dead, or so it feels. And in such circumstances, you can't help but love. You love your mom and dad, the Vikings, hamburgers on the grill, your pulse, your future, everything that might be lost or never come to be. Intimacy with death carries with it a corresponding new intimacy with life. Jokes are funnier. Green is greener. You love the musky morning air. You love the miracle of your own enduring capacity for love. You love your friends in Alpha Company, a kid named Chip, my buddy. He wrote letters to my sister. I wrote letters to his sister. In the rear, back at Gator, Chip and I would go our separate ways, by color, both of us ashamed, but knowing it had to be that way. In the bush, though, nothing kept us apart. Black and white, we were called. In May of 1969, Chip was blown high into a hedge of bamboo, many pieces. I loved the guy. He loved me. I'm alive. He's dead. An old story, I guess. Cambridge, June 1994. It's 5:25 in the morning, June 7th. I have just taken my first drug of the day, a prescription drug, oxazepam, which files the edge off anxiety. Thing is, I'm not anxious. I'm slop. This is despair. This is a valence of horror that Vietnam never approximated. If war is hell, what do we call hopelessness? I have not killed myself. That day, this day, maybe tomorrow. Like Nam it goes. For some time, years in fact, I have been treated for depression. $8,000 or $9,000 worth. Some of it has worked, or was working. I had called back to memory, not to memory exactly, but to significance. Some pretty painful feelings of rejection as a child. chubby and friendless and lonely. I had come to acknowledge, more or less, the dominant principle of love in my life, how far I would go to get it.